When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome to episode 132 of The Ethical Life, a place where each week we talk about the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, social media manager for Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hello, Scott.
The 2020 presidential election had the highest voter turnout in 120 years, with 66.8% of citizens 18 and older voting during that election. But that still means that one out of three eligible adults, that's 80 million people, stayed home. When asked, non-voters told pollsters that the reasons they didn't vote were, one, not being registered to vote. That was about 29% of those people. Two, not being interested in politics, about 23%. Three, not liking the candidates. That was about 20% of the non-voters. Four, a feeling that their vote wouldn't have made a difference. That's what about 16% of those surveyed said. And finally, being uneducated or undecided on whom to vote for. That was about 10%. Rick, I think we can agree that states, and they run our elections, should make it as easy as possible for people to vote. But when there are few barriers, many still don't participate. Why do you think this is?
In preparation for this discussion, I looked up some numbers from Pew Research Center about voter turnout in a number of different countries. And we don't rate particularly high among countries that have democratic elections. We're fairly low as far as voter turnout goes, but we're about the same as United Kingdom, and are better than Japan or Canada, for example, which that surprised me. We're also very good, better than any other country in the world, at turning out our registered voters. So in the 2020 election, 94% of registered voters showed up to vote, which that strikes me as really high.
It's just that there's some who just don't register, and I guess by definition kind of choose not to be involved.
Yeah, so when you have an overall voter turnout of 62% and registered voters turnout at 94%, that shows you that the people that aren't registering also aren't voting. So I would say that we have a number of people, probably about a third of the country, is just not very interested in politics, doesn't follow it, doesn't vote, probably doesn't pay much attention to the news either.
You may not be listening to this podcast, I'm afraid. One of the things that stood out of me is that the majority of non-voters thinks it makes no difference who is elected president. And again, I guess I want to pause here for a moment and say that what we are talking about right now, especially as we run up to the November election or the presidential elections, in states and cities across this country, we have many other elections for governors, for state legislators, for city councils, for school boards. Those are all terribly important too, and I don't want to diminish that. But focusing for just a moment on the biggest elections we have, and that'll be the one, of course, in November, it strikes me as odd that non-voters think it makes no difference who, and again, likely whether Joe Biden or Donald Trump is elected. I think personally that we probably overstate the influence our leaders have on our lives, but to say it makes no difference, I just think is not a healthy sign of our democracy.
I think we overstate and understate in different ways. So we overstate the president's effect on, say, the economy.
Yes.
So that, right, when inflation hit shortly after, Biden was elected president, that's was largely attributed to Biden's economic policies. But of course, Biden's policies hadn't really taken effect yet. I mean, they were, the ground for that was set in kind of global conditions. There was inflationary pressures in all kinds of European countries as well. But a lot of it was due to these vast giveaways during COVID that began under the Trump administration and then Biden continued. So,
and there was some pent-up demand certainly as well.
Yeah. So you have all of these external conditions, and presidents, of course, with their administration respond to them. But so many of the things that happened that we either blame or give credit to presidents for are due to the conditions set up by the previous administration, right? So lots of times when we give a president either praise or blame in a second administration, that's probably worthwhile, especially economically, but not in like the first couple of years of an administration. They're kind of responding to things that are already in motion. We overcredit presidents with their influence on the economy. I think we undercredit them with a lot of other things because, of course, presidential administrations have a lot of power. They appoint heads of all kinds of agencies. And those are the people who have wield a great deal of influence over our lives in ways that we don't normally see, and we don't credit the president with doing that. I mean, like, we should be paying a lot more attention to, during presidential elections, to the kind of people that get appointed to various kinds of secretary positions, for example.
And I think you've said this before, but I can't remember a presidential election on either ticket where, other than, of course, sort of the requirement of picking a vice presidential running mate, where a candidate will say, and if you elect me, my Secretary of State will be this person, and my Secretary of the Treasury will be this person. Those things are just sort of figured out long after Election Day. And I think you believe that doesn't give voters a great deal of sense of how this candidate will become a president.
Well, we think it's very important, for example, how our foreign relations are conducted. That certainly has a great deal of effect on our lives. I mean, if we go to war and we have, you know, either ourselves, our children, our grandchildren are go overseas to fight a war, that you can't say that doesn't have an effect. That has a great deal of effect on your life. And it has effect on the lives of our neighbors and our friends. And so who the Secretary of State is and how negotiations are carried out, this is incredibly important. And yet, yeah, we don't talk about that. I think I wish we would do that. Now, I understand with many cabinet positions, that would be very difficult to do. I think I would say that, like, what's at stake in the upcoming presidential election, there's a huge difference in the sorts of people, not necessarily the specific individuals, but the sorts of people that would be appointed to administrative posts by both Biden or Trump. And so that's a big part of the election that we pretty much ignore.
One other thing that caught my eye in some of these surveys of non-voters is 80% of them say traditional parties and politicians don't care for people like them. Now, I'll say that that sort of narrow casting is something that Donald Trump talks a lot about. He'll go to places where a lot of candidates don't go to and talk to crowds and hold rallies attended by people who often aren't involved in politics. I think Donald Trump probably doesn't get enough credit for involving more people in the political process who were not involved before. Again, setting aside whether you think they're there for the right reasons. But what issue, if indeed 80% of voters still say traditional parties and politicians don't care for people like them, what issues do you think candidates should be talking about more so that number can be a lot lower?
I think that it's part of Donald Trump's brilliance is that he really does speak directly to voters. He doesn't he doesn't poll test his position on issues first. And I think that's really important. And I do think even presidents who've been fairly successful, like Barack Obama, who gets, you know, elected for two terms, appoints an administration that is pretty much all coming out of the elite institutions in the Northeast. And those people in many of those agencies were really tone deaf through the administration to many concerns that came out of, like, the Midwest and the South in particular, many rural areas in the country. And so I think it's not just what candidates should be talking about. I think they don't surround themselves with people who represent really large swaths of the American electorate. And so I don't think it's just what they talk. I think they fail to connect with people because they don't really hear from people. They aren't surrounding themselves with the right kinds of advisors.
And just to pause on the candidacy of Donald Trump for just a bit more, one thing that his opponents have been saying about him as early as when he first ran for president, certainly when he was running for re-election, and now that he's running for a second term again, that he is a chaotic candidate, and that critics will say that, I think Nikki Haley, in much of her criticism, is saying that chaos seems to follow him wherever he goes. That was an early criticism way back when. Remember Jeb Bush when he ran against Donald Trump? That was something that Jeb Bush talked about, was that he just seems to be very chaotic. And it's interesting that that seems to many like a really obvious criticism of Donald Trump. But there's some interesting studies that are coming out more recently that show there is a fraction of our society who, those people sort of crave chaos, that they think our institutions are broken. And the reason people like Donald Trump, and maybe especially Donald Trump, are appealing to them is because they don't respect these traditions and institutions and the ways we've done things, and that we need to blow it up and start over, and that chaos is sort of a motivator for these folks. I know this is something you thought a lot about, and I was curious what your thoughts on that topic were now.
Yeah, I really like that piece that Derek Thompson wrote for The Atlantic a couple weeks ago on the need for chaos and how there's a certain portion of the electorate that really wants destruction. And in that piece, Thompson quotes a 58-year-old New Hampshire Trump supporter who lives in a house that's worth nearly $1 million. He's got a good job, family. You know, he seems somebody who is an example of an American success story. And yet what he says is that the system is broken. And he says he supports Donald Trump because he thinks he can create a, quote, miserable 4 years for everybody. And this seems kind of puzzling. Like, why would anybody want that? Especially if you've had what seems, you know, by kind of, you know, standards or anywhere else in the world, like a pretty good life. Why would you want to tear the system down? And yet this is what a number of voters say. And Thompson also quotes a leader of the Black Lives Movement saying, if this country doesn't give us what we want, then we will burn this system down and replace it. So it's not just on the right. There's feelings on the right and left. And what I think is even more significant than this, what turns out to be maybe 5% or so of the American public who really actively seeks chaos with no further political agenda. There's a large number of people in both parties, and I think maybe even a majority of people in both parties, who excuse chaos when it supports their side. So, for example, during the George Floyd protests, we had, you know, a number of campuses where, you know, statues of Abraham Lincoln were knocked down. And Democrats largely excuse that, saying, well, that's completely understandable, and well, we have racist systems that need to be that need to be changed. And and then you had the January 6th invasion of the Capitol building, and Republicans largely excuse it and say, like, just a few people that got out of hand, and these are protests over a, you know, an election that was stolen. And in both cases, you know, people on the other party couldn't understand why one party was excusing this overtly destructive action, right? That wasn't just random destruction. It was destruction that was politically pointed, like driving right to the heart of American ideas about a democracy. You know, toppling statues of Abraham Lincoln on a college campus and, you know, invading the Capitol and destroying it inside. And so it's, you know, Thompson is quoting the research of Michael Bang Peterson on these chaos creators or chaos seekers. But there's also a lot of what I like to call chaos enablers in both parties. And that's puzzling to me because, why is that happening? Why are people so disenchanted with a system which, like, as I pointed out many times, by almost every measure, human life has never been better. When we talk about advances in equality, health, longevity, there's all kinds of measure by which things are getting better. They're not equal for everybody, but they're better than they were at any time in history. So this is a really puzzling phenomenon.
Well, and I'm not going to unlock the puzzle entirely for you here, but some of the reasons that I have been thinking about on this topic are really mirror some of the topics that we've covered on this show. We've said how we're not as connected as communities as we used to be generations before. Our institutions are looked at much more skeptically than they used to be, sometimes for good reason, sometimes for not. We spend too much time alone, I think, than we used to. And again, I want to be upfront here. I think we've talked on this show quite a bit that I am not a religious person. However, I do wonder sometimes where in some parts of this country where a lack of religion or a lessening impact of religion in people's lives can kind of lead to this. You know, I find it interesting when you look at surveys around the world that the countries that are often the poorest, that often have the most hardships that their citizens face, that are places you and I would probably never want to visit and certainly not live, often have some of the highest rates of religiousness. And I think that is because those people can lean on that for a sense of hope, for a sense of direction, especially during difficult times. And I think you look at more prosperous countries, especially across Europe and certainly even across this country, where the number of people who attend church is getting smaller and smaller all the time. I just wonder if you don't have things like churches or community groups or just people you hang out with to sort of talk through these thoughts you have, talk through these feelings you have, that it does lead to sort of this burn it all down mentality, because it can quickly look like there's not any other option.
Yeah, Scott, that's really good. And you actually anticipate quite a bit of what I'm trying to say in my column that I'm writing this week about this, like what else explains this phenomenon that we're seeing about the need for chaos? And I think you're right, we're feeling worse about our lives at the same time that things are getting better. And
yeah.
And religion is one of the things that we use to help us feel better about our lives. You mentioned that, you know, it gives us a sense of direction or purpose. It does this by having us reorient our concerns internally. So we ask ourselves, like, well, what do I care most about? What's my responsibility here? Whereas, you know, what Michael Bang Peterson does in this research about chaos seekers is he says it's mostly due to a loss of status.
Yes.
Right? Well, status is an external measure of how we're doing in comparison to others. And by external measures, like everybody has low status because you're looking at where you are in relation to the people above you. You're never looking back down and saying how much better that you are. You're always looking at where you're trying to go. And so everybody except the person at the top feels low status. And
everybody but Taylor Swift is what you meant to say.
Exactly. And maybe Travis Kelce. That there's very few that are satisfied with their status because there's always further to go. What religion does is says, but that's a false measure of well-being. It says, like, the measure of your well-being, you have to look internally. What's the state of your soul, to use really old-fashioned words? And I've been reading in the last few weeks, I've been rereading a couple of books by Edith Hamilton, who wrote a lot in the 1960s about ancient Greece. And she wrote a couple of books, The Echo of Greece and another one called The Greek Way, and in which she says this, that the decline of Athenian democracy really came when people started wanting a government that would provide a comfortable life for them. And when that became the foremost object, then their ideas of freedom and self-reliance and service to the community were obscured to the point of disappearing. Like, the very things that made democracy possible was this thought of our mutual dependency and that we each had a responsibility to do our share to contribute to the common good. And once we stop thinking about our own obligation to one another, and we started instead thinking our government is something that gives us things, then democracy started to fracture. And I think we're seeing the same thing here, that we've had a very prosperous society. But if you start thinking that the whole point of this prosperous society is just to give us things, including status, then we end up being really dissatisfied with it.
And just swinging back a little bit to the people who usually decide not to vote, there was a story that we'll link to as well from the New York Times Magazine talking about how the people who did a vote in the past, you know, obviously both campaigns are trying to attract them because most everyone believes that this will be a close presidential election in November, and motivating those who haven't voted 4 years ago could make a big, big difference. But in the story, the very last line or last paragraph of the story really jumped out at me, because it was talking about tactics that the campaigns may use to attract these people who otherwise might sit on the sidelines. And the tactics often are bringing up fear and anxiety. And there was a quote that said, it's just a very visceral way to get people out to vote in a polarized environment. The Trump and Biden campaigns seem to know this already. Neither is serving up hope. And so the pivotal question of 2024 has already become, which voters are going to be most provoked into action? Those terrified by the idea that jobs and neighborhoods may be taken over by immigrants, or those horrified by the possibility that their constitutional rights and democratic traditions may be radically curtailed? One thing is certain, there is nothing like the prospect of catastrophic loss to get voters rushing off the sidelines and onto the field. So I think I guess my position, and I don't want to speak for you, that I would be very surprised if we hit those record turnout numbers that we saw 4 years ago. But I also think we both agree that having higher voter turnout is good, but is this method to motivate those disinterested voters good and helpful?
No, it's corrosive to democracy. There's an old there's a Bible verse in the New Testament. For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? And I think I'm reminded of that by this strategy of trying to motivate voters by fear and anxiety. I mean, even if you win on that record, like fear and anxiety are corrosive to the very soul of democracy. So, like, how have you made the country better? Like, you've got power, right, for your side, but you've got it at really a terrible cost. And so I see this as really a cynical move that happens too frequently in politics, where politicians are guided by, you know, their campaign advisors who show them like the most effective strategies. I don't think it's true, by the way, either. I think the message of hope, when it's really grounded in a proper understanding of what we are doing and where we're going, it can be incredibly effective. The problem that as a superficial hope doesn't work at all. And so if you're telling people to be hopeful, but without giving them kind of any solid understanding of where you plan to take the country and how, of course people aren't going to respond to that. And then a message of fear and anxiety might be more effective in the short term. But I think historically, Americans have responded really well to strong and articulate leaders who've given a message of hope that's also realistic.
And, you know, we don't have to go back. I mean, you can go back 200 years to find those people, but I think you don't have to go back even that far. In our lifetimes, although I was not able to vote for Ronald Reagan, he certainly had many of those rhetorical skills. Bill Clinton, despite all his foibles, was a good communicator as well, and I think inspired people to do good things. And certainly Obama, famously in 2008, ran on hope and change and was a very aspirational candidate for not only people of color, but for many Americans who brought him and elected him to office twice. I don't think that either of the candidates we will likely have in November, Joseph Biden or Donald Trump, have that ability. That I don't think that they are these aspirational or hope-focused leaders that voters turn to and say, gosh, this place, voting for this person just makes me feel better about this country. I think in many cases, they're voting too often against the other guy. And so maybe my question to you would be, this is, I think we can certainly agree that this year will be the last year we will have a Donald Trump and a Joe Biden on a ticket. I cannot see any scenario where this will repeat itself. Well, frankly, if one of them wins, they'll be constitutionally ineligible. So is there some huge opening for some politician on either party to come in and just really take a different tact, a different message, and really inspire people from both sides of the aisle to, again, maybe come together on an issue or two, sure, but also just feel less bad about where we are as a country? To me, that seems like a great opportunity. But at the same time, it also takes a very special set of skills. And I don't know who that person is.
Yeah, I don't know who that person is either. I certainly think there is that opportunity. And we know that this happens, you know, historically, that leaders will often come out of nowhere and they'll come out of nowhere in times of real darkness. And I think we're in a time of real darkness. I mean, even though the economy is really seems to be humming right now, and we're, you know, we've certainly got, there's some serious conflicts in Ukraine and in Gaza, but we're not in a state of worldwide war. We're nothing like that. Like, we have been at other times in our nation's history. I think we're in a precarious position, and I would be surprised not to see somebody step forth as a kind of unifying figure at some point, though I don't think it's going to happen before the 2024 election.
No, but, you know, I am certain there are people, candidates on both sides, who are looking to see, again, I hate to start talking about 2028, because that's a long ways away. But you know there are candidates who are looking to position themselves for what will likely be a very open primary on both sides. And I think all Americans hope that we get a good set of strong candidates that inspire us more than the ones we have now.
Are we going to be receptive to it? That's what I wonder. I think there are a number of Americans that are looking for that kind of leader. I don't know if it's the majority of Americans. Maybe the right kind of leader would change minds, would bring people around.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, what is your question for me?
Well, Scott, there's a recent Wall Street Journal story about a group of amateur sleuths who steal bikes from bike thieves. They go online looking for stolen bikes and recover them for the owners. So my question for you is, if you had a bike stolen and you found out where it was, would you just steal it back?
So, Rick, a couple of weeks ago, I was giving you a hard time because you asked me like some really dreary question about like, would I lay off someone who was facing a serious medical condition? And that was like really, it sincerely was a difficult question and
yeah.
Made me think. And one of those things where it felt like there was no right answer. This is not that. This is like super easy. And we'll link to this Wall Street Journal story because it was fascinating. But not only would I, if I somehow knew where this bike was, I would be happily, I don't think I like the verb steal it back, but I would return it to its rightful owner. And reading this story about this gentleman it was in Washington, D.C., is that right?
Well, there was one in Minneapolis. I think the first guy they talked about was in Minneapolis.
And again, we both live in a city that's probably a little too small to have this, but honest to goodness, if this were going on in my city, I might be tempted to contact them and see how I could participate. I thought it was a great story. I think this is, there's no ethical dilemma here at all for me. Not only would I be more than happy to take my bike back if I was able to find it. And again, I think the story did go into a bit of detail saying that they do require people to have licensed their bike. And these vigilantes, if that's what you want to call them, are only going to take bikes back if they can absolutely know through license stickers on the bike or serial numbers or something that they're in fact returning the right bike to the right person. They're pretty careful, and that's good. So, yeah, I think that's great, and I support what they're doing. And if I were in a city where that was going on, I might even help.
Well, and I called it steal back because one of the examples of the story, the guy goes, poses as a bike buyer.
Right? Yep.
He goes and takes it and asks if he can take the bike for a test drive. And he dresses in very nice clothes, and the guy says, well, I'd want some collateral. And he says, well, do I look like the kind of guy who would steal a bike? And so he lets him take the bike, and he just rides off with it.
See? Yeah.
He basically steals it back from the bike thief, I think.
Yep.
You don't think that's problematic at all?
Not one little bit.
Okay. Well, let me complicate things just a bit here.
Okay.
Let's say you are walking down the street, and you see your your bike, and you can tell it is your bike, in the backyard of somebody's house. Now, you don't know if this is the person who stole your bike or somebody who bought it, like on Craigslist from the bike thief.
Correct.
Would you go and knock on the door and say that that's my bike, or would you just like jump in the backyard, grab that bike, and ride off with it?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would probably, what I would think I would do in that scenario is grab the bike, take it off, and bring it home or somewhere secure, and then go back to the house or and knock on the door and say, in case you're wondering why your bike, the bike back there is missing, here's why. Because you're right. They could have been a buyer of a bike and not known, or they could have been the person who took it. But I think I would go back and I think that's what I would do. I guess the other option was I could leave a note and say, in case you're wondering why that bike isn't there anymore, here's why. Because there is a possibility that this was something they bought on the black market, if you will, that they would probably want. I think they would want to know what happened to it. So, yeah, that's what I'd probably do.
Yeah. So I asked this question of my students over the weekend, and one young woman who's had three bikes stolen in the last couple of years. And so, of course, she was absolutely of course she would just steal back. But they were all pretty much said with what you said. And I think they're right. I mean, their opinion was like, it doesn't do much good to contact the police on something like this because they're just too busy. They have bigger things to worry about. And so you can register with them that your bike was stolen for the sake of their record keeping, but they're probably not going to get it back for you.
So you added a little layer to that. I'll do the same to you. There, in many cities across this country, bike theft is a problem. And one thing that some cities have tried doing is use what are called bait bikes. And these are where law enforcement will put a bike out in probably a fairly busy area that is either usually just not simply not locked at all. And they'll either be people watching it and ready to react, or they'll put some sort of small GPS device on it so it can be tracked, and they will leave it there and wait until somebody takes it and then apprehend that person after they take the bike. There are some people who think that this is just not a good idea because it's entrapment, possibly, or you know, you could be walking down the street having no idea that you're going to steal a bike that day, and there's one that's sitting there and looks nice, and you're awfully tired, or you might think that your kid back home could use a bike, and it's sort of a crime of opportunity, and you just, without thinking it through, grab it and go, and obviously may get cited by law enforcement for doing that. What are your thoughts on the bait bike programs that some cities have?
Well, if they're putting just this like an ordinary bike here, even an older bike, and they're just setting it out with no lock on it at all, so that it makes it really easy for somebody walking by just to pick it up and ride it off, that seems a little bit more like it could be considered entrapment than if they put like an expensive bike that they know statistically gets stolen quite a bit.
Or especially when you get to these, you know, several thousand dollar e-bikes.
Or e-bikes that, you know, these are really high ticket items that thieves are targeting those bikes. And they say just put an inadequate lock on it.
Yeah.
What they're doing then is they're using it to find people who are regularly stealing bikes.
And who may have an operation that they bring this back to, and they don't find just this stolen bike, they might find 50 more.
Yeah, and I don't find anything wrong with that. That's not entrapment. I think that's just good law enforcement where they're going back. They're using they're using the thieves' own actions to find out and stop who are the people that are responsible for most of the bike thefts. A couple years ago, I had a pair of skis stolen, and I didn't think I'd ever get them back. And but I reported them stolen. They weren't a very good pair of skis anyway. But about 6 months later, I get a call from a police officer in this town, like it was 100 miles away, that they'd found my skis. They had arrested somebody and found that he had like 50 or 60 pairs of skis in his basement. And mine were among them. They had serial numbers from all these skis. So they're contacting whoever they could. But I mean, I think that's what would happen in many of these cases, that they would find somebody who has a lot of bikes, not just one or two.
And I think, I'm thinking of my bicycle, and, I've six years old. I don't know. It's not a new bike anymore, but I've ridden it a lot. I've maintained it very well. It means a lot to me. It's just a bike. I've often told the bike shop where I get it in to bring it in to be repaired that I just know that someday this bike's going to be past its useful life, and I'm going to have to buy a new bike, and I'm convinced I won't find one I like as well. So if I tried to sell my bike, like on, just to put an ad out, I don't know, it might get $75, maybe $100, but it's been well maintained, but it's not going to get a lot of money. It's just not, but it means a lot to me. If my bike or a bike like mine was used in one of these bait programs, it's not going to be one of those $4,000, $5,000 e-bikes that are highly coveted. It's just a 7-8-year-old bike that's been relatively well maintained that means a lot to me. But I think that's why I think this is interesting, is that I guess there's a lot of products and a lot of things in our lives that are like this, but this has more value to me than it would to almost anyone else, right? So like if this were gone, I can't go out and buy another bike for $100 is going to mean as much to me as this one that's going to work as well for me as this one. I think that's why I support these programs, is that I don't know. I just don't have, I would have no hesitation if the city where we live started doing this and using, bikes that are worth $100 to catch people who are stealing bikes. And in some of the studies they've done on this, it can really make a significant dent in bike theft citywide if this is like well publicized. But it sounds like you're a little less gung ho on this because of some, I guess I don't know.
I don't think I have any objections. I'm just saying there's a difference between using it to try to catch bike thieves. So these are people who are regularly stealing bikes, and say a kid who is walking by finds a bike lying on the ground on the sidewalk and picks it up and rides away, did something stupid that they shouldn't have done. If that's the kind of person you're trying to catch with this by making it so easy, I'd say do something better with the time. I mean, that makes me a little uncomfortable. But doing a program that really is focused on catching dedicated bike thieves, great, I'm all for that. That's the same with speed traps, mm-hmm. that are set up in towns that are catching people that are going 2 or 3 miles an hour over the speed limit, versus catching people who are really speeding. That's the difference I'm trying to get at.
I'll just end this with one thing I bet you will think is ethically challenged. And this is, I'm certain, a tactic that no law enforcement agency would ever do, but private citizens have done and set up hidden cameras and captured this to share on social media. But they will put out, a private person will put out what would be called a bait bike for someone to take. But the twist is they will loosen the handlebars or make the wheel super, you know, almost nearly unattached. So the person gets on and pedals 30 feet, and the bike just sort of collapses out from underneath them. And, you know, the tire falls off or the seat, you know, whatever it is. And it, does that seem like a step too far to you?
It seems like an exercise in Schadenfreude, where you're taking pleasure in the misery that you're causing somebody else, and you feel good about it because, after all, they deserve it because they stole the bike in the first place. But
and then you can post it on social media and get, you know, 250,000 clicks on somebody whose tire rolls out from underneath them and they face plant into the yard because they stole a bike that wasn't theirs. But you think that that's not a great idea.
Well, it just shows a lack of character on the part of people who are doing it. Like, find a better use of your time. There was a video trending on X recently of some guys who followed somebody that was walking out of Home Depot with a cart full of, of cordless drills and, you know, other high-ticket items. And they followed him out, shouting at him that he hadn't paid for his stuff. And they end up beating him up by his
truck. Oh, my goodness.
Because they kept telling him to just leave the stuff there. And they're saying, like, you're the reason that all these tools cost so much for us, because people like you are stealing them. And of course, they have a point at that. But, he refused to let go of one of the things, tried to get it in his truck. So they attacked him. But this then trended on video because, of course, people feel good about, like, seeing somebody who has broken the law get his due. And yet it's also kind of uncomfortable to watch it.
That's what I'm
responding to. I think I wouldn't like to see our society move more and more towards a kind of righteous vigilantism.
I think we can end on agreement there. As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe to the Ethical Life wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, which touches on many of the topics we talked about today. And that can be found on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite, I'm Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.